All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Chasing Edges podcast. I'm your host, Brian Peters. Got absolute dynamite podcast this week, Eric Lichter. He's the co-founder and owner of Plus Two University here in Columbus, Ohio, which is a speed and strength institute where he's coached many athletes, 31st round draft picks, LeBron James, Ted Ginn Jr., Beanie Wells, the list goes on and on in the private sector. He was also previously the head strength and conditioning coach for the Ohio State University football team under Jim Tressel. So he's got a long resume, but what he brings to the podcast this week is 25 years of wisdom and knowledge, particularly in the speed industry. So we spend a lot of time on that, and it's a very, very great conversation that can save you a lot of time if you pay attention. A lot of focus on volume and intensity, how to use technology to gauge your athletes, how to use movement to assess your athletes, all in relation to speed and optimizing the athlete. The focus is always on the athlete. We emphasize that on the podcast, but he has a lot of good perspective shifters, both for myself and hopefully for you, where it's, are you a workhorse or a racehorse? He's the guy I got that from. And then the understanding that you don't plow a field with a Ferrari. All fun conversations, and then we finish off with some stories about guys battling through the NFL combine process, how to properly approach that, then also people in that industry, how to suffocate the ego and share information to get the best out of yourself and your athletes, which obviously learning, sharing, growing, that's the Chasing Edges way. So hopefully you can steal some nuggets from this podcast and enjoy. E, welcome to the show.
Hey man, I'm pumped to be on this show. I've caught a couple of you guys' casts, and they're fire, man. So I'm pumped. I don't know what we're going to talk about today. We'll get into it though.
Well, I'm just intrigued to talk to you in general, just because I've been training with Ebner for 8 years now, and like he has incredibly high standards for people that he respects in the industry, particularly like people that help like take him where he wants to go. And he couldn't speak higher of you. So obviously I want to break down, then obviously I got the chance to come in here and watch you train Kobe Bryant, the cornerback for the Seahawks, with Schlegel one day, and got to see part of the process, and so much intrigued me, and you saw so much intention and just like the 100% effort you're giving to your guy. And then obviously like I was able to see the bare feet and the VBT stuff. You were a beautiful mind on the board breaking that down for Schlegs, and then like the breath work that showed up in the benching, like so. Like you're like very visibly a very captivating coach, but like very like all in. So I wanted to start breaking down the mind behind it. So I appreciate you stepping on. But yeah, how we start the podcast? Where are you chasing edges right now? Where are you learning? Where are you growing?
Yeah, and I love the name of that podcast, by the way.
Hell yeah,
creativity goes a long way, right?
Yeah,
but it's very symbolic of, you know, what you're interested in, what I'm interested in, and what, you know, your casts have been about. The edges that I'm chasing right now is really, I think, on the science side. Mm. Because for so long, when I was a young coach, I'm 47. I'm doing this a long time now. Man, I'm a dinosaur. when I was a young coach, we didn't have technology like this. We didn't have the ability to measure performance. We didn't have these very accurate, specific things that we can look to. And that as a coach, if you're a passionate coach, it's about the athlete. It's about the client, right? And you want to do the best you can for those clients. And so that comes down to, I think Siri is listening in. We've got so much tech in this room. Yeah. I don't know how we're going to,
but it's being used for good.
Avoid,
yeah,
that. But you want to make the best decisions you can going forward, right? You want to make good decisions about the path we're going to travel down. That wasn't always so clear back in the day. Like you just kind of threw some stuff up on the wall. Hey, I learned this in a book. I'm going to try this. I'm going to do that. So now with really being able to lock in accurately on how an athlete's performing, are they responding to the training? Are they doing too much? You know, maybe their nervous system's tired. You know, you just get so much information, and it really helps you. I think, you know, here's an example of it. I used to like bang my head on the wall, writing out like 12-week training programs and periodize this, and everything had to be and I don't do that anymore at all. I write programs week to week.
Mm.
You know, that's a huge change because you're going to make a change. Nothing that you're thinking is going to be the case before you start is going to be the case because there's always going to be things that are going to make you turn. So the edges that I'm chasing are just really using science and the technology that's available and trying to get my head around it. Cause you know, you can also be analysis by paralysis. You can use too much science, too much data. You still have to rely on the eye and, you know, the good old coach's eye, but really just chasing like usable right now data that can keep the train moving and not just using it with the elite athletes like the pros or the D1 guys, but more the developmental athletes. That's I'm trying to really chase how I can build a system and get middle school and high school athletes measured, monitored, adjusted, and developed, and do it on a massive scale. Like, I don't want to just measure one or two. I want to measure hundreds, right? Mm. So that's a challenge because technology is not cheap. And when you're really doing things from a science basis, training doesn't happen fast. You can't just take 25 guys through a 1080 sprint workout like you know, in 30 minutes. Doesn't work like that.
Yeah, I mean, you said a lot of interesting things there where, like, obviously with the technology, like I had Josh Storms on here. He's the head strength coach for Florida State, and he basically has a team of guys come and like basically bring it in front of him and like, is it interesting or is it actionable? Like, can I use this? Can I apply it? And then obviously when you start to look at the training system as a whole, like, there's a lot of limiting factors, and your 12-week program can be perfect on paper, and then you put it into a multivariable system, multiple humans. Like, obviously everybody's different sleep, different workouts and those kind of things. And then now, like, everybody reacts differently. So I still think I think the system week to week is dope. Like, I think it's really cool because like, that's how adaptable, like, as a coach, like, you need to be to, because like, you're chasing plus 1% every day, whatever you're looking for on these guys. And like, if they're not in the right state, if they don't respond to this program, like, okay, let's not wait 12 weeks to change it. Like, let's start to adjust now. And I think that's the coolest thing because, but before we get to that, what are you doing with these kids? Like, what types of tech and like those kind of things are you applying and seeing results? Are you seeing results more with the younger group with the technology or the pros?
Well, you're always going to see, I think, quicker changes in younger athletes, right? Because their window of adaptation is wide open, right? You can almost, the fact of the matter is, you could provide very inefficient, what I would say is, I never say something's wrong or right, bad or good, but if someone showed me a program that I would think, you know, not, I wouldn't do that. That's not what I would do, but with young athletes that their windows of adaptation are wide open, you can almost do something that most really good coaches would look at and go, I wouldn't do that, and get results.
Yeah.
Right. But you couldn't do that with a Kobe Bryant. You couldn't do that with an Olympic sprinter, right? Eric Harrison or a Navia Battle or a Troy Lane. You couldn't provide them, you know, poor, inefficient, from a science standpoint, you know, I couldn't endurance train those guys when they're true racehorse sprinters,
yeah,
and get faster times, right? I get slower times. Okay. So, but with younger athletes, what we're doing a lot is we're, you know, we train movement here, right? Most of the athletes that come and hire us want to get faster, right? They want to move more efficiently. And it's not just linear speed. Field athletes very, very often don't move in a straight line for very long. They've got to accelerate. They've got to decelerate, reaccelerate, right? Change direction and motion. So we're really looking at velocity, not only how an athlete starts when they start moving from zero, how much force can they initiate to get started? How well do they accelerate? Acceleration is probably the you know, from a non-track athlete perspective, from a field sport perspective, probably the most important.
Yeah, it's a separator, no doubt. And it pops on film, and like, but it also like eliminates mistakes. It does so many things.
Yeah. I talk about it all the time. Like, every time I talk about acceleration, I think about Boom Heron, right? Ohio State running back, stud. Coached him for years, played, you know, multiple years in the NFL. Boom wasn't a lights out speed guy. He didn't have, you know, elite top end speed, which means that once he's past sort of getting started, accelerating, and now he's trying to get that speedometer up to 21, 22, 23 miles per hour, he's not going to get that speedometer as high as a Ted Ginn Jr. or Troy Lane or some of these other really fast guys, Chimdi Chekwa, some of these guys I've trained that are just, I mean, they get that speedometer up there. But Boom would go from, his Boom was like a Tesla, man. He'd go from zero to 60, like right now, right? Which is why he was a great player, because the running back, you've got to see a hole opens for a brief moment. You got to hit it. And then he was a tackle breaker because he was so strong and so powerful. And when you have force and speed coming at the same time, that's power, right?
Yeah.
So he'd accelerate like crazy, and he just, he'd deliver the blow to you. So he was a hard guy to bring down. And he wasn't a huge, he's not like a, he wasn't like his counterpart Beanie Wells.
Not
he wasn't
a thumper, a, yeah.
He wasn't a huge guy, but he was just so powerful. So, you know, we're looking at start speed, which, believe it or not, that's kind of a oxymoron, because your start ability is not, has nothing to do with speed, right? It's like load velocity profiling. Yeah. When your speed is really high, right, the force is very low, right? So think about someone running full speed, their foot's hitting the ground and it's coming off the ground in a millisecond, in a micro moment, right? They can't put as much force into the ground because the ground contact time is so brief. Whereas when you're starting from zero movement, your ground contact times are the longest because you're gonna push the hardest to get going. So your speed is very low when you start because you're at zero, you gotta work up, but your force is the highest, right? So start has nothing to do with speed. It's actually based on strength or force production. But then as you accelerate, that's power. And then as you reach sort of that technical, that max velocity, right? That's true top end speed, or what we call max velocity. So we're looking at those three things all the time, because we're dealing with, hey, I want to, baseball player, I want to run really well at the baseball combine. The 60-yard dash is that benchmark, right? The football 40-yard dash, right? Standard benchmark. Track and field, indoor, it's the 60-meter dash. That's the Preakness, right? Or, you know, in outdoor track, it's the 100-meter dash. Those are the true racehorse races, right? So we're in, from a speed perspective and from science with the 1080 sprints and some of the GPS stuff that we work with, we're looking at those things, right? How well do you start? How well do you accelerate? How well do you transition? And not only are we improving your max velocity, which is critical. So are we 1 mile per hour faster at the back end than we were 6 weeks ago or 6 months ago? And then not just are we getting the speedometer higher, are we able to stop it from then coming down fast, right?
Yeah.
So if you think about like in a 100-meter dash, like think about Olympic gold medal race, most of these athletes are, you know, they're trained to accelerate, and they don't really hit their peak, the very ceiling of where they can run, that, you know, they don't really hit that till about 50-55 meters, right?
Yeah.
Football players hit, we want to train football players to hit that peak way earlier. They want to accelerate much steeper because that run is shorter, and we need them at their max velocity on that back 20 yards, right? Mm-hmm. To really do well in that 40-yard dash. But if you think about that 100-meter dash, it's the person who's decelerating the least from the 55-meter mark through the finish line that usually wins the race. Assuming that these guys all are very close to one another, that's why they're the last eight guys on the planet running for that medal, right? So it's, you know, it's about, you know, accelerating and maintaining and not burning energy, right? And then who not only peaks out the highest, but who finishes the race without the sharpest decline from that peak, right? Because you can't maintain anything. You're always accelerating or decelerating, you know, here or there based on physics, friction, all these things. But basically, like, that's why Usain Bolt is such a an amazing guy, right? For him to have peaked out at 12.9 meters per second, which is insane. That's like 26 something miles per hour, right? Like, but he finished at 12.2. So he didn't lose speed, right, at a rapid rate. He came down very gradually. Another guy who was like that was Ted Ginn Jr. Mm. Very much, very similar. Take him a long time to he needed a longer runway.
Yeah.
He wasn't a Boom Heron. Boom Heron could land his plane on a very short runway, like Ted, or, you know, take off on a very short runway. Ted needed a longer runway to get up off the ground. But man, once Ted hit top speed, he didn't fatigue. He didn't let off the gas pedal.
Yeah.
He had a speed reserve that was incredible.
Yeah. Can we look at both ends of those spectrums? So like, how do you, again, master like maintaining that peak speed, or like, because I kind of like, in the breathing world, I look at it as like carbon dioxide is like a bell curve of performance. So like, in some essence, it sounds hydrogen. Like speed, yeah, speed's the same way. Yep. Where like obviously you come up to, and now it's like how long can I keep that drop off from coming? Like, so how do you maintain that like top speed, or like avoid the deceleration? Is it mechanics? Is it strength? Is it function? Like, what are, then on the other end, like how do you master that acceleration?
Well, the first part is a combination of a few things. So like, how do I get really good at decelerating the least over distance, right?
Yeah.
Mechanics are definitely play a big role in that, because the more inefficient you are in mechanics, the more energy you burn, right? And once we start dropping down energy systems from the most explosive energy system that allows you to fight or flight type energy, right?
Yeah.
Like I always, you know, I have different stories that I tell different age athletes. So if I'm talking to an older guy, I might say something crazy like, hey, if I'm, people listen to this podcast, but oh my God, I've heard him say this a million times.
Yeah.
Like, hey, because I'm always talking about the nervous system, about the brain and how it.
I love that world. So yeah, feed me.
How it connects with motor units, right? And the biggest motor unit activity is sprinting. So like there's no exercise you can do that involves more motor units than sprinting. That's why I love track and field, because track and field is a maximum output game. It's not a maximum effort game. Mm. It's a maximum output game. You're not rewarded for producing 80% or 70% of your speed for hours and hours and hours. You want that? Go do CrossFit. Okay.
Yeah.
That rewards you for that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But track doesn't reward you for that, right? Track rewards you for maximum output. How far did you jump? The furthest you've ever jumped, you get rewarded for that, right? More, I just PB, personal best. The least amount of time it took you to run that 100 meters, you get rewarded for that. That is all like what I call fight or flight, right? So if I'm talking to an older athlete, I might say, hey, if you're texting on your phone, your brain's sending an impulse, and it's not involving a lot of motor units, right? But
yeah.
God forbid you're in a shopping mall and an active shooter comes in, there's going to be a different impulse.
Snap, it happens,
there's going to be a different impulse that's sent from the brain down to all the motor units, right? But if I'm talking to a young kid, I may not use that example. I may say, hey, I live over in Powell, Ohio, right across the street from the Columbus Zoo. God forbid you're walking down the street and one of those big predator lions is out of the cage and hasn't eaten for a while and is coming for you. How are you going to run? Are you going to run like you do when you're conditioning at soccer practice, or are you going to run in a different way? I'm going to run in a different way. Yes, that's what I want here, right? Because I want that nervous system to have to be on absolute all hands on deck 911 system, right?
It's like a dimmer. Like, so like I want a burning fucking nuclear fire
bomb,
like,
right?
I don't want a bonfire,
right?
And like that's where like I love the workhorse versus the racehorse analogy or scenario. Like that's, and we talked about it last time I was here, but that's where I love that analogy really rung true with me, because I always in my mind, like blue collar work ethic, like that's what got me there. That's what's going to keep me there. So I was workhorse, and I had to be the hardest worker. I had to be there the longest, whatever ends up being. But like that, when it came to my body, even my mind followed suit too, where it's like, no, I need to be high performance for this short window. I'm a racehorse. And like, that's where, like, again, hindsight's 20/20, but if I could go back, I'd train more the racehorse analogy for football.
Yeah. And like, to that point, and to the keeping, you know, max velocity, the body only can take so much wear and tear. So while you know, big, strong, yoked up dude, you know, put a lot of effort and a lot of intensity, probably had a lot of workouts, who knows how much longer your career could have been if you would have just cut, you know, everybody's different. There's not like one formula that fits all, but if you would have cut down some of the volume from over the years and maybe increased some of the intensity. And what I mean by that is like intensity in the racehorse world is, okay, we ran three sprints out on the track, and every one of those sprints, we were within 99% of our max speed or velocity, right? That's intensity to me. Intensity to somebody else may be, hey, we pushed a sled with four plates on it 500 yards today, and I can't walk out the door because my legs are quivering and I'm not going to be able to walk for 3 days. That might be intensity to somebody else. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think if you cut down on some of that work intensity and sort of the less is more, quality beats quantity all the time when it comes to like getting faster, becoming more explosive, right? You know, maybe less injuries, maybe less, you know, time, yeah, you know, down in the training room, maybe, you know, recovery a little bit quicker. The body's amazing, you know, at how it can recover, but there's a balance between there. And when it comes to like maintaining max velocity, mechanics play a huge role because you don't want to drop down energy systems, right? The minute you have to go from your creatine phosphagen to fast glycolysis, now you're not burnt, you know, you're not dealing with energy that's available in the muscle right now. Now you have to burn sugar to create energy, and then you're dropping down. Once you start dropping down energy systems, right, it's like downshifting, you're not going to be able to maintain, you know, maximum velocity, or it's going to sharply decline. So the way you do it is you work on mechanics, you work on efficiency, right? And you train for it. So one of the ways that we do it is, you know, we might start an athlete on a 10 meter fly run, which means, you know, you get a certain amount of run up into that zone that you should be at your top speed. And then you measure that zone, right? So that might be over 10 meters. We train that, we get better at that, we improve that. And then what do? We extend. Now we're going to go to a 20 meter fly, and we're going to lock in on now double that distance. And we're going to do the same thing. We're going to train it, we're going to work it, we're going to get more efficient, we're going to video it, and then we're eventually going to work up to that 30 meter fly, right? So it's like anything else. It's a progression, it's coaching, it's feedback, it's training the body and the nervous system. And it's, you know, it's like anything else. It's like overcome, adapt and overcome. The body will, you know, specific output based on imposed demand, right? So you give it training, the body will get better at handling that. Or, you know, give it stimulus, the body will get better and say, okay, this is what we're going to do, I'm going to get good at this, I'm going to adapt, right? So it's sort of, that's kind of the process of that. And then there's other factors that play into a role too, but.
Yeah, so just out of my curiosity there, because again, to the workhorse racehorse analogy, like as far as like the aerobic capacity, and I want to get this back to like the how you train movement and how you evaluate movement and then apply all this stuff and that kind of thing. Because if in essence I'm only doing three reps out there in max effort, in my blue collar workhorse mindset, like that's not enough. So if I'm an athlete, is that enough? Like can I get away with that and still be able to, again, have enough aerobic capacity for my sport? Let's talk football in particular. Like, are you like, is part of your programming ripping like three high intensity reps and then training, or how's that look?
It depends. So one of the interesting things that I think plays a role into this in my world, there's a difference between like if I'm a college strength coach and I'm responsible for the entire program, right? I'm responsible for 100% of this athlete's preparation. Yeah. That's a different animal. I've got to build a foundation. I've got to be able to have a player that's a football player. I've got to be able to have him be able to repeatedly produce maximum output for an 8-play, 10-play drive, right? If this kid can only go out on the field and run down, if he's a linebacker, and he can only run sideline to sideline for two plays, he's got to come out. He's not ready to play the game, right?
Yeah.
So you adjust your training. But for me, like, and in my world every day, I don't have, like, I can't count on athletes you're going to train every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. In this world of like being in the private sector, these athletes have so much going on. There are multiple sports there. There's so many things that their training sessions are sometimes all over the place. There's no consistency to it, right? It's like a dot, a dot, a dot. So that's why building programs week to week and sort of sometimes session to session matters. And science has shown us that microdosing, which means hitting a little dose of speed here, a little workout, you know, tends to be more effective than anything, right? So, you know, with some, getting back to your original question, which was like, is three reps enough? It really depends, right? Yeah. On like what the situation.
Too many variables. Yeah.
Like if you know, I had a couple soccer players who were here all summer before they were going to go for their freshman seasons to play D1 soccer for the first time. And we spent 90% of our training working on speed, power, movement. They all have a conditioning test looming at the arrival of, you know, getting to school. And they're like, what are we going to do for the conditioning test? And I'm like, here's what we're going to do. You're going to do the conditioning test on, you know, Wednesdays and Fridays, and you're going to do them outside of here on your own. And what are we going to do? The conditioning test. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, you like, train what you're training for. Yeah.
You are going to run the conditioning test. There's no better way to pass a conditioning test than to do the test.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you have to do half the reps. Maybe you have to adjust the intervals because you can't make them, right? Yeah. So if you got to, you know, whatever it is, you're going to give yourself a little bit of, you know, what we would call missed reps, but that's okay.
No grace,
there, yeah. And you're, you know, your aerobic and anaerobic energy systems will improve and adapt to that imposed demand, right? Yeah. That you're placing on it. So you're going to do that. And every one of them, because it's amazing what really pushing speed and power will do. And it's not like we only do three reps. Like sometimes I'll train 400 meter runners that really they're 200 and 400 meter runners. And, you know, so 360-yard or 60-meter runs at really fast speeds is not enough. We might hit a lot of repeat 60s. So we may have 10 60s or 8 60s on 90 to 120-second recoveries. Well, if you take 8 times 60, that's 480 meters, right?
Yeah.
But if I ran them in a 400-meter run without stopping, their speed would the average speed of that 400-meter run would be way lower than the average speed of all those 60 repeats.
Yeah.
So if I hit a 60 at 22 miles per hour, and then 120 seconds later, I hit another 60 at 22 miles per hour, and then another 120 seconds later, I hit another 60 at 21.5 miles per hour. After 8 60s, I basically covered 480 meters of distance at speeds that are far above, right?
Yeah.
The pace speed that I need to be successful in my race. And if I would have trained with more distance, all my speed would have been at 14, 15, 13 miles per hour. I'm going to tell you something right now. On the track, the guy who's training at 22 beats the guy who's training at 14 every time. As long as, because if you think like 8 repeat 60s at that intensity, because we talked about, right?
Yeah.
If he's fatiguing, and he's no longer at 21.5 miles per hour, or what I would say is 95% of his maximum
velocity.
Can't
maintain the intensity.
One of two things has to happen. I got to do less reps, or I got to give him a little bit more recovery time, right? Mm. And then each week that we train, I can manipulate that recovery time, or I can manipulate that distance. Maybe we're going to go 65 meters or 70 meters. Maybe we're going to go 100. My point is I can still tax the conditioning systems that give you the base to be able to run a 400 without the bottom dropping out, right? Yeah. Or to be able to go on a 10 play drive without the bottom dropping out.
Yeah.
The guy who can only play two plays and he's so gassed, he's going to throw up on the sideline, the bottom dropped out. So we can still assimilate that all day long. But back to the soccer point, what I was going to make was we still pushed speed. It's amazing what speed will do as long as you're doing the minimum amount of conditioning to be successful versus way more conditioning than you need to be successful with very little speed. I don't like that formula.
That's chess, not checkers, yeah.
And that happens a lot. If you would have looked at Troy Lane, so Troy Lane is a great example. Troy's an incredibly and talented sprinter. Set the state record in the 100-meter dash at Pick Central last year as a junior. He's coming back this year for senior.
Yeah, shout out Pick Central.
But yeah, there you go, yeah. You know, this kid has the potential. He could potentially run the fastest 100-meter dash since FAT timing, you know, fully automated timing's been installed. He could break the 9.98. He could be that fast. If you would have looked at the training that we did, I did most of Troy's training for the whole track season. Great collaboration with the Pick Central track coaches. They had a team to train. He's a little bit different racehorse. You're talking about maybe the fastest kid in the nation.
Yeah.
You know, in his age and maybe even one of the fastest kids in the nation, including collegiate sprinters.
Okay? Yeah, let's go.
And he's so they were okay with, hey, you know what, he's going to need a little bit different, you know, a little bit more. If we focus on him, we lose the team a little bit. If we set the pace to the team, we don't give him what he needs.
Right? Yeah.
So I handled most of his training. If you would have looked at what we did, I guarantee you 95, I hate throwing these numbers out, but a very large majority of high school coaches, even college coaches, would have looked at our volume and said, that's all you're doing? That's it? And the results speak for himself, right? The kid ran 10.6 last year at his best. This year he runs 10.25, sets the all-time state record. But if you looked at the 4x1 relay that he ran, which this has had millions of views on YouTube.
Yeah.
If you look at the anchor leg that he ran on the 4x1, which if Pick Central doesn't win that relay race, they don't win the state title as a team. He edged out the Gahanna Lincoln sprinter he was down 8-9 meters at the handoff. So Troy took the handoff at the middle of the exchange zone. So he still had 8 to 9 meters to go around the curve to then hit the 100-meter straightaway. He ran a 9.91 split on a 108-meter run. And he ran down. That Gahanna Lincoln sprinter was not some chump. That wasn't an 11.6 kid or 11 kid. Was a 10.8 sprinter. And Troy ran him down and edged him out to beat him. It was one of the most incredible walk downs you've ever seen, because it wasn't a 4x2. He didn't have 200 meters to do this. He only had 108 meters to make up that gap. But Troy's top end speed is ridiculous.
Just shows you his potential. Is
ridiculous, right? So if you would have looked at like the amount of volume that we would do, you'd be like, that's like 1/20th, 1/30th the amount of meters that you, right? But we didn't. It's not like we go out to the track and do 3 reps and go home. There was a lot of drilling, mechanics, vertical upright positions, a lot of block work, a lot of what we call speed drilling. But then the meat and potatoes of the speed workout sometimes were 3 good runs and done, or two good overspeeds, 80 meters and done, because those are big time hits to the nervous system, and less is more. And for Troy, one of the things that was really, you know, I think eye-opening for people to see was how much he peaked, like from districts to regionals to the state final, just how much time kept dropping. And it was dropped not because of training. The training was already done. It was dropped because he was rested, totally non-fatigued, and his central nervous system was just tweaked and ready to go, right? So less is truly more. And when you guys, so many times the model is backwards. These track athletes that are heading towards state are getting worked more and more and more. It's the wrong way. You gotta work up less and less.
Rest is productive.
If you haven't prepared them by now, what have you been doing?
Yeah.
Like way back in the beginning, right? So that's just an example of like no, not everybody just does 3 reps or this or that, but conditioning, you have to do enough to make sure the bottom doesn't fall out. For me, I don't know about other coaches, but once I've done that, I'm not interested in any more conditioning. I don't want the conditioning to go down. I don't want it to drop off. Once I've created the minimum standard to be successful,
minimum effective
dose,
I'm not
interested in any more.
Yeah, I'm putting my energy where it needs to go.
I'm putting my energy in. I want, you know, I'm not trying to plow a cornfield with a Ferrari, okay?
Yeah.
You do that with a tractor. I'm trying to take that Ferrari and I'm trying to see if I can break that speedometer.
Yeah, that's elite. Yeah, I like that separation standpoint, because now, like, all your then, because now you start talking compound interest on these separators, which acceleration is a separator, top end speed's a separator. Like, obviously you see that in football, you see the pull away, and like it's a game of inches where like at one step gets separation for a receiver, or the back hits the gap, linebacker hits the gap, whatever. So like that makes logical sense, and I'm all about logical training. And yeah, go ahead.
Just before I forget what you just said, like on the football field, you saw the amazing rundown when DK Metcalf ran down Baker.
Yep.
Do you know the difference between that their speed was 1 mile per hour?
No, that's crazy.
Yeah. Anyone who thinks Buda Baker is like slow or something is crazy. That
elite,
dude can fly.
Elite speed. Yeah.
Dude ran a 4.4.
Yeah.
He got run down. You know, in that run, and DK Metcalf's max velocity was 1 mile per hour faster. So look at what 1 mile per hour looks. You see two cars going down the street, and you watch them over, you know, a very long distance by 1 mile per hour. You may not really see the difference, right?
Yeah.
Look at it in human form on an athletic field and see what it looks like.
Yeah, nuts.
It's nuts, 1 mile per hour, right? So when you say chasing edges, I'm chasing 1 mile per hour, because that is a game changer in field sports, in, you know, in the world of human movement. 1 mile per hour is a game changer.
That's a great point. Hopefully my guys can put some clips to the DK and the Troy and all that kind of stuff, just because like it is funny that you don't think about that simply what 1 mile per hour looks like. So, okay, like, again, like, I can condition and I'll run everybody else into the ground, but, like, on the football field for that 4 second play or however long it goes, like, what's a separator? Mile per hour is a separator, like, another amount of force on the acceleration separator. That it makes sense to train.
What if that was the last play of the game and Baker had to take that in the end zone to win the game?
Yeah.
You know? You think back. I mean, it's not so simple. It's not so black and white, but you think back and you say, hey man, should I have spent more time in the summer getting faster, or should I have been in better shape?
Yeah. Well, I look at like, what's another example of a play like that? Like the James Harrison touchdown in the Super Bowl with the Cardinals, maybe those 11 guys like should have, and the guy, like somebody should have not been on the sideline, but those guys could have trained for another mile per hour, you know?
Yeah.
Could have, it's a Super Bowl separator. And like that, now it gets fun. And, but to get back to some of the other styles of training too, is like where obviously I've heard and I've seen some of the process of being elite is like the combine prep and those kind of things. And like, that's, you just want to take it and run with it. Like, do you like, obviously I'm sure you have your stance, but like your attention to detail is elite from what I've seen. And then like, obviously I love the barefoot stuff. Obviously you're doing acceleration and training for a 40 and these deals, but like Ebner, I know, tested out of the gym, like,
oh my God,
like 6'2" something, 3 cone, which they like made him run it again. He ran a 6'4", but like, that's good God. Like, and then, so I just like, I want to hear about your process or your stance or where you think people get it wrong, wherever you want to go with it.
You know, and I don't think too many people are getting it wrong in this day and age. One of the best things that social media has done, there's a lot of
sharing of information. Yeah. It's a massive tool.
There's a lot of negative things social media does, especially to younger athletes, right? I'm like a part-time psychologist for 14-year-olds sometimes, right? But not many people are getting it wrong in the combine world. And there's so many good coaches out there now. And if you're not up to speed with your toolbox, I'm not going to call you a bad coach. I'm just going to say maybe you're a young coach or you don't have enough tools in your toolbox yet. But there's so much good information out there. There's so many good coaches that have influenced from the private sector what institutions are doing, like college strength and conditioning programs or professional organizations. But in the combine, it's a very you know what the test is going to be. Like the combine has, there's not this like unknown at the combine. Like, you know exactly what they're going to do.
Yeah, the competitive stadium, massive unknowns, formations, athletes, good day, bad day.
That's what makes sports great, right?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
And that's why, like, movement, I know you know me, like, as we've talked over coffee, and you know I'm going to talk about movement first, weight room second, versus the traditional model, right?
Yeah, which is nails. I put up that quote a while ago, but it's if you train movement, you won't miss muscles. If you train muscles, you'll for sure miss movements. And that is so fucking logical. It's nails. And it's like, well, like, so why would I not train my movement? Why would I not master my movement? Why do I not feel my movements before I, like, okay, like there's functional aspects, okay, bench, O-line, D-line, whatever, and like squat, leg strength, whatever, but like, you're gonna miss muscles if you're only, again, doing five different exercises, seven different exercises. You're not gonna hit everything, and it's not gonna fire in its functional pattern, but go ahead, sorry.
No.
That's your world.
I think I saw that quote, I saw Exos maybe had made that quote or something, but it was the best quote I've ever seen, and I've used it time and time again because it nails it, right? It's so well
articulated.
Less. Right? Yeah. It says a lot in a
next
very
question.
Little word. Say less, right? And so you uncover things anecdotally that you don't sometimes connect till later. Like, I used to always say to other coaches or my coaches or just people in general, I'd say, man, you know, I see a lot of guys that are built like Tarzan, but they play like Jane. Mm. And I've seen a lot of guys that are built like Jane and they play like Tarzan. Why is it? Is it because they're just mentally tough? Is it because they've got heart and courage? And it's certainly some of those things, but they move so damn well, right? They move and they're athletic, and you don't have to have chiseled muscles like a bodybuilder to be athletic, right? I think of a guy like Teddy Bruschi, right? Like, I'm from Arizona. I grew up in Arizona, Teddy Bruschi could walk through the door and Bruschi and you wouldn't, it's not like he looks like Nick Bosa or Joey Bosa or something, right? Or DK Metcalf, right? He doesn't walk through the door like, oh my God, this guy is like the most, or David Pollock was another one like that. Like, these guys aren't just these, right? But God darn, man, could that guy get to the quarterback? Did he know how to play the game of football? I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
versus guys like, you know, there's the Alonzo Spellmans of the world and stuff, but you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, well, that's where because I think some guys get lost in comparison where it's like, oh, I should look like that. Like, that's what an NFL football player looks like. No, it's the NFL player is the product, not the NFL player's muscles and that kind of thing. Yeah. So it just like.
And in this day and age, you know, coaches can build the chiseled athlete through the process of training movement, right?
Yeah.
Instead of the other way around and missing it. So, you know, but the combine is, you know what the tests are going to be. So you can train specifically and make sure that your guys are locked in. And it just comes down to really being efficient, right? Your agilities, your short shuttle and your three cone. There is, in my opinion, only one way to run those because, you know, the goal is minimize time, right? You want to get from point A to point B, and in some cases, point A to point B to point C to D and back around to where you started. And you just learn over time, like inside leg turns as opposed to outside leg turns. You learn these things over time and then you master them. And, you know, these are very different, even though you think like, well, if this is the combine and they're measuring if this is going to be a good football player, why is it so different? It is different. These guys don't work on inside leg turns and three cones in the majority of their college experience, right?
Yeah.
And too often, college programs are not necessarily working on max velocity enough. Max velocity, we just talked about it in the beginning of this podcast, right? The reason max velocity is so important, even if you only touch upon it a couple days a week, is because, or one day a week, microdose it, is because if you improve max velocity, you have to have improved everything that came before it.
Mm.
That means acceleration and startability, especially if you're dealing with the right distance. If you're dealing with really long sprint runs, 200s, 400s, that's not necessarily the case. But in a 100-meter dash or 40-yard, if you've improved your top-end speed, you've improved everything that came before it. you could work on startability, you could work on acceleration and never actually get to top end speed. And you could improve the first two things and not have improved the back. It all happens all the time in football. Football is a cone drill world, right?
Yeah.
We sprint with all these bursts and all over the place and all these cones and all these redirections. And that's great. That's great for, you know, tissue development. It's great for, strength, force, acceleration, deceleration, absorbing force. It's good for injury prevention if those movements are efficient, if they're being coached. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the guy can then get that max speed up, right? So the 40-yard dash is my point, is the grandstand event. And it's become everything. It's even important for linemen now. Did you see whether you believe the timing's accurate or not? Because there's difference between FAT timing in that combine system and the guy who's using the second part of that system, which is the hand trigger, right? Yep. And you saw a little bit of the debates. The receivers ran really ridiculously fast, and then they, it doesn't matter. You could see that everybody at that NFL combine last year ran faster than in years previous. And the offensive linemen, for the most part, every one of them broke 5 seconds. When have you seen that?
No, crazy.
How about defensive linemen, 340-pound D tackle running 4.8, and he was moving, right?
Yeah.
George's guy. So, speed is important for all of them. And most college programs, they're so intent on work. Remember when you were in college?
Yeah.
And remember when you were dealing with your Eric Lichter, your summer strength coach? He was so geeked up on 3 hours of work every day in the summer, because the strength coach has become the head coach in the summer, right?
Oh, yeah. Almost. I mean, they have the most impact on the players, in my opinion, anyways, just because their exposure.
They do. But it's their show, right?
Yeah.
Can you imagine a strength coach being like, hey, man, it's Thursday. We're gonna be in here for 45 minutes, dude, and you're going back home. Can you imagine what the head coach would be thinking? Like, dude, you sent those guys home after 45 minutes. You gave them a day off over the summer. What the hell are we doing? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's weird that's how cultural it is. And then, you see it in, the strength and conditioning world in general, because it's, almost ingrained where it's, even your job, you have to GA, so you have to grind and do all and take classes and do all these things. And then, it's just, you have to earn it. And, that's a football mindset. Coaches want to have the toughest team. We're not going to take it easy on guys, blah, 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 blah. But it is not effective to some extent. And it just how do you rewire? I think the sports science world and the sports performance world, I think private, again, is influencing the public or the mainstream universities and those kind of things. But
I think they are. And, it's tough. I've been on both sides, which I have the perspective. I've been on the other side where I had to prepare Ohio State's football team every summer. And as a coach, I would be worried about max velocity, because how much did this guy drink over the weekend? How much sleep has he had, right? How much? And then our program throughout the week just continues to tear down, tear down, tear down. We got a lot to work on. We got to get position drills in. We got to get stronger, especially our freshmen, our incoming guys. They got to get stronger. We got to get bigger. We've got to be more explosive.
We got to be the toughest.
We got to be the toughest. So we've got to have our fourth quarter conditioning, right? Yeah. All these things. So it'd be tough to I'm going to pull up with 3 10-80 sprints here, and I'm going to overspeed my guy 60 yards, and I'm thinking about hamstrings popping and getting fired, right, and all these things. So it's tough, but I think that and GPS is involved now, so you can monitor load and how much load was at these velocities.
Another great tool.
So it's difficult, and that's why you see, the NFL combine business thrives, and many facilities, not just a few, are very successful, because the coaches that understand that these guys are coming off of pretty much 6 months straight of, work, nervous system's going to be, tired, and that the true central nervous system fight or flight response, the true maximum output, connectivity and system that I love and talk about so much, has been, I don't want to say ignored, but has not been stimulated even close to the level that it could. So when you get a combine guy and you've got 8 weeks, if you know what the hell you're doing, you should be able to increase a guy's vertical jump 3 inches, 4 inches, pretty much in 4 to 6 weeks. You should be able to drop a 40 time, a tenth or two tenths of a second in 6 to 8 weeks if you know what you're doing and you understand how to dose speed and power training. And there is zero reason to do any conditioning during the combine training except for position work.
Yeah.
One day a week, we position drill our guys and we put them through that 15 minute all out assault period that they're going to go through when a position coach from a team works out that position group, or, you know, a scout comes in. They essentially get 15 minutes on the clock, and this is at the end, right? So all the maximum output tests are first, and then that, you know, that position period is at the end. And you put 15 minutes on the clock and they can just grill you, right? And the thing you're always hoping is that you're not the only guy.
Yeah, for sure.
That's
I've been there,
That's a prospect at your school, because then we got any other D linemen? I'm the only D lineman. I'm always like, dude, who are the linebackers? Who are the hybrid linebackers on your team? Get their rear end to do a little bit of the D line work
or even if they're not showing up, or if they're not really going to the league. Yeah.
Yeah. To get them in there. Yeah. Like, 'cause you need rest. Right. Yeah. So we definitely will do that, and we'll condition the guys, and it's hard, and we gas them. They're in oxygen debt. They're fatigued. Right.
Yeah.
But other than that, we ain't touching it. I'm not touching it, because my job is to get his vertical up, his broad up, right? My job is to get that track race, that 40-yard dash to just pop off. And, you know, speaking of Kobe Bryant, you know, I got to tell this story. And Kobe would come on here and be like, he told you exactly how it went. A lot of people don't know this about Kobe. They do know he's a hell of a football player, right? He's starting for Seattle, and you know, fourth-round draft pick, but a lot of people don't know that Kobe had back surgery. He had invasive back surgery very close to camp last season. And he had to have it because he was going through training and the back just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And he wouldn't have been able to play. He had to have that surgery. Had it. Got his rehab, what the normal amount of allotted rehab and what I call RTP, return to play.
Yep.
The normal amount of time that would be given to an athlete was cut short by about 35%. Just from the nature of when he got the surgery. And it's not like the Cincinnati coaches like pushed him. Kobe pushed himself. They're like, hey, we're starting camp. He got cleared to play. Now, it doesn't mean that he was going to be 100%, but the doctors felt like he was safe enough to go out and compete. But he had no type of summer program.
Yeah.
He had no type of conditioning for his legs, no type of speed and power training. He was in a freaking rehab
state.
For spinal, for disc surgery. You with me? Goes through camp and is just like dealing with
everything. Yeah.
A deconditioned athlete playing at a Division I level. And Cincinnati was pretty damn good last year. And, you know, anyway, the kid, fast forward, has an amazing season, wins the Thorpe Award, and comes to me for combine training. But keep this in mind. Didn't they play in the Final Four?
Yep.
They sure did. So I didn't get him until after they lost to Alabama.
Yeah.
I got him. I had 2 weeks to work with him. Then he goes to the Senior Bowl for more what? Football.
Yeah.
Football. Change of direction. I'm not going to call them cone drills. That's Senior Bowl is real football now.
Yeah.
Then after the Senior Bowl, he had 11 days to train. And then he was going to Oklahoma to get his Thorpe Award.
Hmm.
And that's banquets and pageantry. Yeah. And that's not
a lot of variables in his training. It sounds
that's
like
that's not fly in and fly out.
Yeah.
That's like go there for a week. Then he comes back from that. I've got 10 more days and he goes to the NFL Combine. And then after that, I've got 2 weeks and he goes to Pro Day. Training needs to not be broken up.
Yeah.
What people don't know is that Kobe Bryant came in to day one, and when I assessed him, he ran a 107 1.07 and 0.07 of a second, fly 10.
So moving, or that's slow. And
that's
then fly 10.
Slow.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, yeah, I was thinking first 10 yards.
You need to be
0.95.
Yeah. You need to be under 1 second, right? Significantly, you know. The guys that run 4.3 in the 40-yard dash or 4.4, they're running 1.84 to 1.88 fly 20s.
Okay.
A fly 20 is a 20-yard run-in, and then you time. So essentially in the 40-yard dash, it'd be from the 20-yard line through the 40.
Yep.
Not from the 0 to the 20, from the 20 to the 40. Guess what that's called? Max velocity, right? 1.84 to 1.88. So they're covering this in significantly under a second per 10, right? He ran a 107. That correlates to a 4.9 40. Okay. I've known Kobe his whole life. He used to run around as a kid in his underoos in my facility in Euclid, Ohio, speed strength. And I first started training his brother, Christian Bryant, before Ohio State, before I was his strength coach at Ohio State, in the private sector, the whole Glenville high school connection. I felt an obligation to this family, and Kobe Bryant was a very accomplished, accoladed, trophied up player. But the reality was, is with the back surgery, the lack of training, the lack of central nervous system, big motor unit, you could call them fast twitch, whatever you want.
Yeah.
The lack of stimulus to that system and to those muscle fibers left them dormant. And what happens to a muscle fiber when you, I don't want to say ignore it, but you don't stimulate it.
Atrophies.
It atrophies. It doesn't disappear. It doesn't split. It just shrinks. And that means it produces less force, and it produces it at slower speeds, right?
Yep.
We needed to stimulate those and get them to come alive again. But I needed 8 weeks.
You needed time.
I needed time.
Time's a variable.
I am panicking. I am freaking out. I'm calling Ronnie Bryant. I'm calling Christian. And I'm like, he ran a 107. What the hell?
Yeah.
Can he skip the Thorpe Award, please?
Yeah.
Because who's the pressure on?
Yeah, the coach. Like, he's your product.
He's my product. The pressure's on me. And it's like, he's a cornerback in the major college football, and he won the Thorpe Award, right?
Yeah.
So when he ran a 4.54 at Indy, all the people who don't know what the fuck they're talking about are bashing his speed.
Yeah.
He's not an elite corner, 4.5. He's got to run in the 4.4s and this, that, and the other. And I'm sitting here going, this is the greatest speed job we've ever done, right? Yeah. Like, no one knows.
Context is everything.
It's everything. Like, he ran a 107, and I don't give opinions on shit. Like, if I tell you this is what it is, I measured it with a NASA satellite, right? When people say, what's so good about the 1080 sprints, I'm going to say they don't make mistakes.
Mm.
It's like a NASA satellite, okay? I can be precise, and the 1080 doesn't lie.
Yeah.
Okay? Technology's there. So we got him down to a 4.5 with all this broken up shit. He's in town, out of town.
So his potential's off the charts. Yeah. Or like, especially for a 40-yard dash that's training and not completely specific.
I left Indy feeling like unbelievable. Right? I've trained multiple guys who have run 4.3 on that turf at Lucas Oil. Okay, I've trained Olympic sprinters. I literally left there feeling like this was the best job me and my team have ever done. Kobe was pissed off, not at us, just pissed off at like the
understanding of
the
his results.
The atmosphere of what everybody goes through at that time, which is they're not told how good they are anymore. Everything that they can possibly pick out a flaw is written about.
Poke holes
because every NFL team wants a reason not to pay you, right? Not to get, so he's just so angry and mad and like, just trying to block out the white noise that's social media, but it's hard, right?
Yeah.
And he's just like, let me line up on anyone that you think is fast, and I'll cover them like a blanket. I'll shut them down, right? Whatever. But I said, Kobe, we got two. Here's the best thing. Even though we haven't had 6 to 7 weeks of uninterrupted training, we've laid the foundation. We've seen the central nervous system come alive. We've seen, you know, now the only thing that's missing is just that next gear that you're not moving the ground from 0 to 20 like you will in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I said, when we get back from the combine, now we've got 2 straight weeks of uninterrupted training. We're going to put the icing on the cake and then we're going to go to pro day and we're going to tear it up. And we're going to run in those 4.4s. Man, did we kick ass at pro day. Like, you watch that video. Some teams had them, you know, because this is all handheld shit.
Yeah.
So there's lots of variants, right?
Yeah.
And some teams had them in like 4.39. So they're going to throw those out.
Yeah.
And some teams had them in 4.51. They're going to throw those out. The majority of the teams, and there was all 32 teams there, had them between 4.42 and 4.48.
Yeah. Let's
so,
go.
So that solved and answered the speed question, right? But the point I'm trying to make is that's how important, you know, understanding
the process and the product that shows up in your hands. Yeah,
correct. And understanding the context to, like, I knew about the back surgery and all that, and I knew what we were dealing with, and I knew what we were up against. And so there were some things that I just changed in his plan because I needed more plyo, more, you know, we had a lot of isos. We had to do a lot of isometrics to get started. And then it was like plyos and speed, right? Fuck the condition.
Yeah. Like, but I think the point, like a great coach is adaptable, like particularly in the world of speed, top speed and acceleration. And because it's crazy to think that in a college program, you're going to, like, your program's going to fit the 100 athletes that you got to do. So I know we're ticking on time. We got
one thing I will say just to try to wrap up is, you know, we've talked so much about speed, movement. I think if there's one nugget that I can leave with young coaches that are listening to this podcast or college strength coaches or whatever it is just, you know, I've been doing this 25 years and, you know, I failed more times than I've succeeded, but I've learned every time. And I'll tell you, I think that people ask me all the time, like, what have you learned over 25 years? I've learned that the model, I think, is not as good as it can be. I believe that most sport coaches, most high school coaches, college coaches, and these are sport coaches, strength coaches, personal trainers, therapists. Everything starts in the weight room, and then they build their speed and their movement priorities around the weight training program. And I believe that it's exactly opposite. I think everything starts with movement. And that's not speed. That's movement. That's mobility. That's, you know, all those things. Three planes of motion, right? How smooth, how coordinated, rhythm, timing, but it starts with movement and speed, and you use weight training as a tool to enhance those. You build your weight training priorities around your speed and movement priorities. They come first. And when I flipped that model and I really started to understand the movement muscles, you know, we talked about it, man, everything made sense to me. Like, it's no longer, it's so crystal clear. So it's very easy to have athletes from all walks of life, all different needs, come into my sort of lane, my alley, and I can figure it out because it all stems. I start with movement, and that's everything. So there's never a question of, like, what are we going to do? How are we going to get started? I know where we're going to get started because the first thing I'm going to do is evaluate how you move. And then from there, the plan gets built.
Yeah. And so that some of that might be like range of motion on the movement. Some of it might be weaknesses in muscles or explosion, that kind of thing. That seems like the most logical starting point, particularly because, like, that's what they do. And then now you know all the tools and, like, all the strength coaches are versed in all the methodologies. Periodization, how to strengthen each muscle, but, like, how does it apply? Like, it's just a piece of the puzzle in the weight room. You're looking at the finished puzzle.
And so much is advanced. Like, you just watch athletes warm up now and you see that they, you know, core temperature up, activation, right? Stimulation. And then they, you know, there's a nice rhyme and rhythm to how an athlete warms up, and you'll see guys bounding, single leg bounding, alternate leg high knee bounding before a football game, and they're waking up, They're getting their central nervous system turned on. You see sprinters now, they touch max velocity in their warm-ups rather than think, I'm going to fatigue. And then their first race actually essentially serves as a warm-up rather than, you know, there's just so much good information being shared. And all those coaches out there that are studying it, that are in the arena as you speak and are seeking information and are willing to get uncomfortable and are willing to admit that I don't know everything about everything and I can learn from other coaches. Like it is not, you know, I look at Les Spellman and I look at other coaches and XPE and man, those guys do a phenomenal job. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with connecting with other good coaches and sharing ideas. And there's nothing wrong with sharing credit. You know, there's nothing wrong with giving the athlete credit. You know, it's not all about you, the coach, right? Like you're not the, you know, you might be part of the process, but let's just get more, you know, I'm not saying don't be hungry. I'm not saying don't be competitive. I'm not saying don't go out there and try to dominate. Eat, man. Go eat. But let's calm down the tribalness of my program is better than yours. I'm a better strength coach than you. I'm a better speed coach than you. My track team's better than your track team. Like let's calm that shit down and let's be so obsessed with becoming the best coach you can be so that through you, the athletes that you touch and the other coaches that you influence and the athletes they touch become so fucking obsessed with being that guy that you don't have any time to worry about what's being said about you or who's competing with you or, you know, this. I can't even fucking hear that shit because I don't have time. Like, I don't have time to sit around and say, oh, I'm just like, what's the next... what's the next place I'm going to build?
Sharing,
what's the,
exactly. Growing,
what am I going to learn? Like, I don't have time for that. So let's just become all that we can be. And man, let's lift everybody, right? Because you never know. I'll leave you with this. You could have influenced a coach that without your influence and you might've been so tribal, you thought like, dude, I got secrets and I don't want to give me bro, no.
No, I'm a help and supporter, not yours to keep. Like everybody's helped and supported, give it back.
Exactly, pay it forward. Like I'll collaborate. Now, when we're going to compete against each other, I want to whoop your ass, but I want to help you though, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to show you my game plan, but
exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, but the bottom line is, man, you may have influenced a coach. And that coach may have, because of that, helped a kid. That kid had everything it took to become the Olympian or everything it took to become that first round draft pick. Because at some point, you need to start with something too, right? Like you can be the greatest coach in the world, but you may only be able to get that kid to 9.9. But man, the kid who lived two blocks over from him just had a little bit longer limb length and a little bit different genetics, maybe a couple more percent of the big motor units, right? And that same training would have gotten him and pushed him to 9.6, right?
Yeah.
So you never know who they are.
Yeah, just spread the good word.
So stop with the 8-year-olds. Like, my 8-year-old's going to be the next great. Stop that shit. Yeah. Okay, we'll talk to me when he's 14 or 15, and we'll know by then.
Yeah. Right?
So just, man, let's just keep – I'm so proud of the coaches that are lifting and elevating and sharing and not worried about, man, I'm going to lose business, money, clients. Man, there's enough to go around, and if you're good and you're growing and you're becoming better, you're going to attract, man. You're
guaranteed.
Never going to run out, right? You're never going to run out. So I just wanted to get that out.
No, I love that message, and that's that whole mindset from the start to finish is like why I'm doing this and why Chasing Edges is, you embody Chasing Edges in general. Yeah, I appreciate your time. We pushed over a couple minutes, sorry about that, but
I could talk for another hour with you, man.
Yeah, I'm about it.
Let's
too.
Do it again.
Yeah, guaranteed. Yeah, I'd love that.
What would be cool is get a couple other good coaches in, man. And
oh, easy.
A round table.
So I got a couple other mics and I'm working on more cameras, so we'll get that happening for sure.
Let's do it.
I appreciate you.
All right, man.
Boom.